8 Central Time, I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, NASA astronaut Christina Cook is having her stay on board the International Space Station extended, making it one of the longest space flights ever. We'll find out what it could teach us about how life in orbit can affect the human body. First, what kinds of birds do you see around your yard? Maybe the robins, cardinals, chickadees, blue jays, and maybe some sparrows? Well, what kinds of sparrows? According to a new book, there are 76 kinds in North America that we could pay attention to, and our guest says they're as complicated as they are common. Rick Wright leads birds and art tours in Europe and the Americas, and he's the author of the Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you today.
Well, sparrows, Rick, I learned from your book, are a lot more complicated than I would have thought. Some things we call sparrows are not related to the sparrows we have in North America. Some things we don't call sparrows are sparrows. Sort out for us what fits into this book.
Yeah, the English names of birds are just a huge historical mess. Sparrow, historically, has come to mean just little brown streaky bird that I can't really be bothered to look at more closely and identify. And so there are lots of birds around the world called sparrows that aren't necessarily all that closely related each to the other. Our American sparrows, for example, are not at all closely related to the house sparrows and the Eurasian tree sparrows that are familiar to most of us. But they share the same name because they're about the same size. They're sparrow-sized and about the same color. They're sparrow-colored and about the same pattern. They have sparrow patterns. At the same time, among the American sparrows, we have birds that are called in English sparrow, but we also have birds that are called brushfinch and towhee and junco. So English names have a really complicated but really fascinating history, and they don't always tell us about the genuine relationships of our birds.
And that's something about your book. It isn't just a field guide to sparrows, though it is that. It's also a story of how we as humans have interacted with these birds, discovered them, and tried in different ways to categorize them, right?
That's right, yeah. And that, to me, is every bit as interesting as the birds themselves. Birds are really neat little animals, and I really like looking at them and thinking about them and talking about them. But what fascinates me and has always fascinated me are the people who look at the birds. The people who look at the birds try to figure out what they're doing, try to figure out where and how they live, and ultimately and fundamentally, what they are. What does it mean when we look at a bird and say, that is a sparrow, or, oh, that bird is different from other birds that I've looked at? The way that the human mind works to categorize things using similarity and difference is exemplified in the way that over the last four centuries now, we've dealt with the American sparrows.
And it's changed a lot because now we can look at the DNA of different birds. We can try to figure out their evolutionary family tree. How has that shaken up the way we put birds into this category and not that category?
That's a really interesting thing, and I'm not certain that we have reached the end of biochemical study of birds and their genetics, but a lot of birds that we used to think were closely related just visually or just sort of by gut feeling turn out to be not all that closely related. For a long time, including when I was a young birder 40 years ago, for a long time, we lumped all of the birds with thick seed-eating bills into one great big family. So all the buntings and the cardinals and the dixisole and the sparrows and the towhees, we thought were just one big family, identified most easily by that crushing bill, the bill that they use to eat seeds. But work in the genetics of birds has discovered that these are actually not all that closely related. So while the American sparrows form a distinct group known as a family. We talk about the family of American sparrows. The cardinals, which share a similar bill, are in a different family. The indigo bunting, which shares a similar bill, is in a different family. The old world buntings, which some of your listeners may have seen, are in yet another family. So the recourse to genetic study of birds' relationships has given us a very different picture from what we thought just a few decades ago.
Talking to Rick Wright about his new book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. Rick, when it comes to birding, are sparrows really sought after by most casual birders? Are they the stars of the show?
I wouldn't say that there is such a thing as a casual birder. I think that once you start looking at birds, you tend to get hooked. And as you go on and gain a little more experience and a little more familiarity with the birds, many birders moving beyond that first stage of being a beginning birder, many birders simply fall in love with the sparrows. And there are lots of good reasons for that. Identification of sparrows, in spite of hoary tradition, is not all that difficult. There are really rather few sparrows that can't be identified readily when you get a good view. They have just the right amount of challenge and just the right amount of identifiability to be really satisfying birds to look at. And many of them, in spite of the fact that we think of sparrows as sort of smudgy brown and streaky, many of them are just terrifically beautiful.
Now, you've got over six dozen species of sparrow in your book. Are there any common themes? Is there anything that we could say about all of them, or is there just too much variety to make a general statement?
Well, there is a lot of variety, and it's important to note that the 75 or 76 different kinds of sparrows that are treated in the book aren't all considered separate species. And I'm very careful in the book to talk about kinds of sparrows or flavors of sparrows. Lots of sparrow species are quite variable over their range. The classic example, of course, is the juncos. In the Midwest and over much of North America, we have only one species, the dark-eyed junco, but it has so much geographic variation that we split it, as most birders split the species, into recognizable kinds in the field. So you've got not just the familiar slate-colored and Oregon juncos, but you've got white-winged juncos and gray-headed juncos and pink-sided juncos, just a great diversity even in the unity of one sparrow species, the dark-eyed junco. Across the entire family, it's very hard to identify any characteristics that they all have in common. What comes down to the basis of the modern classification is genetic work. All of the sparrows are descended from a common ancestor.
One thing I found fascinating is looking at the body types of some of these birds and matching it up with their behavior. Like, do they migrate? Do they migrate a long way or a short way? And how that translates into, say, their wingspan? What kind of things can we observe?
Yeah, that's right. And that's a fascinating thing that the birder can actually see quite well in the field or at the feeder. Birds, not just sparrows, but birds in general, that migrate long distances tend to have long, pointed, powerful wings and, for the most part, short tails, while birds that migrate short distances or not at all have short, round wings and long tails, which allow those more sedentary birds to maneuver nicely through thickets and brush piles, but wouldn't allow them to migrate the hundreds or even thousands of miles that some sparrows migrate. So just looking closely at the shape of a bird, looking closely at the shape of any bird, can sometimes give you a hint about its way of life.
In addition to the birds in the book, there are a bunch of recurring human characters that keep coming up from bird to bird. You look at the history of how the birds were observed and named and sometimes accidentally renamed, even though they'd already been named. One familiar name, John Audubon. Can you talk about his role when it comes to the identification of the sparrow family?
Yeah, Audubon is an enduringly fascinating figure. And he came rather late to most sparrow identification, but that didn't stop him. He decided that very often his images, the paintings that he produced, were better than any produced before. And a few times he claimed to have discovered sparrows that had actually been described some time before he first encountered them. So even though he doesn't count as the discoverer of many of our sparrows, he's still one of the most prominent personalities. I think of a bird that is moving in small numbers through western Wisconsin right now, the Harris sparrow, a very large, very beautiful, sad-voiced sparrow of the tundra in Canada. And Audubon named the Harris sparrow for his friend and patron, Edward Harris, and more or less didn't care that the bird had been discovered a dozen years earlier by another of Audubon's friends, Thomas Nuttall.
We are talking about sparrows with Rick Wright. He leads birds and art tours in Europe and the Americas. He's the author of the Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see any kinds of sparrows around your house throughout the year? Do you see any of them right now? Do you have a question about how to identify sparrows, what fits into this family and what doesn't? If you are a birder, I guess there's no casual birders. If you're a birder yourself, have you specialized in sparrows of any sort? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That was the song of the dark-eyed junco, actually a type of sparrow, part of the same family. We're talking about some of the many kinds of sparrows out there in North America. Rick Wright is our guest. He leads birds and art tours in Europe and the Americas. We're talking about his new book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you bird? Do you look for different kinds of sparrows? Have you seen any in your backyard lately? What do you look for around the year? And do you have questions about how to identify these guys for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Rick, you mentioned the Harris sparrow. Who else pays a visit to us here in the Midwest?
Well, right now, those of us on the East Coast, I'm in New Jersey right now, those of us on the East Coast are very jealous because you've got good numbers of Vesper sparrows passing through. Vesper sparrow named for the probably erroneous folk belief that they sing their beautiful song mostly in the evening. You've also got one of the most colorful of the North American sparrows, the little tiny, somewhat secretive LeConte sparrow moving through the Midwest right now. This is a bird with an orange face and a white stripe down the crown and an orange breast and a very strangely colored neck. It's almost purple. It's a mixture of gray and silver and green that looks purple in the field. One of the most beautiful of the sparrows and definitely worth getting out to look for if you've got a chance right now. We're the end of April right now. Another week, you'll start to see Nelson sparrows, another very handsome, colorful sparrow. And you should be seeing right now good numbers of dark-eyed juncos and white-throated sparrows pushing through. Some of the most abundant sparrows on the continent, some of the most abundant birds on the continent, in fact, moving north in big waves the end of April.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bridget is with us in Seymour. Bridget, hi.
Hello. I just love the little white crown sparrows when they come to town. They just bounce along the ground underneath my feeder. They don't necessarily land on the feeder, though.
All right. And what time of year do you usually see those, Bridget?
Oh, well, this spring I'll be seeing them. They always migrate. And the chipping sparrows, they always sing a little song for me.
All right. Right. Bridget, yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Rick.
Bridget brings up a really interesting point about the white-crowned sparrows tending not to land on the feeder but on the ground. A lot of sparrows, like white-crowned sparrows, are fairly terrestrial, spending most of their time feeding on the ground. But there are other sparrows that spend time high up in the trees at certain times of year. Right now, one of my favorites is coming through the Midwest, the clay-colored sparrow. And clay-colored sparrows, which tend to spend most of the year on the ground or in low bushes, this time of year will be quite high in the trees, eating the seeds of elm trees as they form. So that's a neat trick this time of year to help you find some clay-colored sparrows.
Thanks for that call, Bridget. And as Bridget was talking, I flipped open your book, Rick, to look at the white-crowned sparrow, and I see it's one of the most frequently misidentified, I'm quoting here, of passerellid sparrows, even 2.5 centuries after it was described. Why is it easy to mix up with other sparrows and other birds?
Because, first off, the adult with that striking badger-like black and white head pattern superficially resembles the white-throated sparrow. And it can be easy if you don't get a good view or if you're not paying particularly close attention. It can be easy to confuse the adults with white-throated sparrows. More interestingly, the white-throated sparrow has a first winter plumage, that is to say, the plumage that white-crowned sparrows wear for the first 7 months or so of their life, that lacks the black and white. Instead of black and white, which gives it the name white-crowned sparrow, they have rusty and buff. And that pattern and those colors can suggest any number of other sparrows. White-crowned sparrows are often misidentified as chipping sparrows, as rufous-crowned sparrows, as just about anything, because they look so very different from those flashy black-and-white adults.
Well, I like that the idea of it being badger-headed. That makes the white-crowned sparrow a fine Wisconsin bird. Thanks for the call, Bridget. We'll go to Mike now in Green Bay. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. For your guest there, I'm wondering about the English or house sparrow and being an invasive species. And I just started to learn this now, that that they're killing eggs and killing adults and stealing nests, and that people are actually trapping them and eradicating them. Is that true, I guess?
That's true, yes. The house sparrow, which again is one of these sparrow birds that's not especially closely related to our New World sparrows, was introduced to North America in the 1850s, largely by German immigrants who just felt a little bit homesick for a familiar bird that they would see around their towns and villages and barnyards. And so they brought house sparrows into North America to remind them of back home. At that time, in the mid-19th century, there was a lot of agriculture in the United States, so lots of waste grain, and the principal mode of transportation was not the car, obviously, or the jet plane, but the horse. And house sparrows are very happy going through what horses leave on the roads of cities and towns to look for seeds that are left over. So the bird just exploded in abundance and in range and is now found all over North America. People don't nowadays like house sparrows very much because house sparrows are cavity nesters. Our native North American sparrows all build little nests on the ground or in trees, but house sparrows build cavity nests in cavities. They can't dig their own cavities because their bills aren't strong enough. So what they do is usurp the cavities that are dug by woodpeckers and other birds and are occupied by things like house wrens and bluebirds and downy woodpeckers. And house sparrows are pretty rambunctious. They will go into, say, a bluebird box and evict the bluebirds, sometimes even killing the bluebirds. Same thing with some small woodpeckers and wrens. And so there are more or less concerted efforts over much of the continent to control house sparrows. And controlling house sparrows, yes, it means killing them. It means trapping them and removing them from the environment. I'm very fond of house sparrows, but I have to say in North America, I'm fonder even of the native birds of North America. I wish the house sparrows weren't here. They are. We need to do something to protect our native birds. But as long as they're here, I guess we can enjoy our house sparrows, which are very cheerful little birds.
Mike, thanks for that call. We are talking to Rick Wright, author of the Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Hayward. Hello, Jim.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
Wanted to talk about how many sparrows are actually coming through. We've this year so far that seems like not many. We've got one song sparrow, three tree sparrows, and one fox sparrow couple. And we just wondered, it just seems like hardly any.
Jim, thanks for the call. Are there concerns, Rick, about numbers of particular kinds or species of sparrows in North America?
The sparrows that Jim mentioned are all common and doing well, and are generally signs of sort of the end of the first phase of spring migration. So I think Jim can remain hopeful that he's going to see a lot more sparrows coming in over the next couple of weeks. There are, however, sparrows that are in very bad shape. The Florida subspecies of the grasshopper sparrow, a bird that I believe is also listed as threatened, or at least of special concern in Wisconsin. The Florida subspecies of grasshopper sparrow is in very bad shape, very low populations, and declining. It's quite possible that the grasshopper sparrow of Florida will be the next group the next subspecies of North American birds to go extinct, in fact. Another one that weighs heavy on my heart here in New Jersey is the salt marsh sparrow, which has a very long breeding range up and down the Atlantic coast. But as its name suggests, it lives in salt marshes. And it's rare to find salt marsh that's much more than a mile wide. So though it's got a very long breeding range, it has an extraordinarily narrow breeding range. And with global warming and the rise of sea levels, salt marshes are becoming rarer, smaller, more subject to unexpected flooding. And the salt marsh sparrow is another bird that is in bad shape and sadly enough, quite possibly on its way out.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Time for one more caller. Steve is with us in Little Suamico. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Comment and a
question. The storm we had 2 weeks ago, we saw an influx of about 15 to 20 fox sparrows, and they hung around. It's just a blast to watch these little guys scrape through the snow and the seeds and the grass. We really enjoyed them, but we are about 15 miles north of Green Bay in a kind of swampy, wooded area. I was wondering what other type of sparrows we can expect to see coming through this particular area.
In our last minute, Rick, a good swampy sparrow.
Oh, a good swampy sparrow is the Lincoln sparrow for sure. You say swampy woods, and my mind immediately goes to Lincoln sparrow, a very subtly colored but very beautiful, very handsome, rather large sparrow named by John James Audubon for a friend of his in Maine, Tom Lincoln.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot. And Rick, what's the next visitor you're looking for out there on the coast when it comes to sparrows?
Well, I had a great time this morning because I got to see a white-crowned sparrow. They're just starting to come through, a bit more common back your way and scarce enough out here to make a red-letter day.
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk about sparrows.
That's Rick Wright. He leads birds and art tours in Europe and the Americas. He joined us for a look at his new book, The Peterson Reference Guide to Sparrows of North America. Coming up after the news, NASA has extended the mission of one of its astronauts aboard the International Space Station. We'll find out what it could tell us about how the human body handles a long trip into orbit. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Conditions are improving in Columbia County, where flooding forced some residents out of their homes. We'll get an update on the situation there, as well as flooding threats in other parts of Wisconsin, coming up. First, NASA announced last week that one of its astronauts, Christina Cook, will be spending almost a year aboard the International Space Station, making it one of the longest space flights ever. Scientists at NASA will be using the trip to monitor Cook's physical well-being, adding to a growing amount of research on how the human body holds up in space. Megan Bartels is a senior writer at space.com. Megan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, talk about Christina Cook. She's already up there on the International Space Station. She's having her stay extended now to 11 months. How does that stack up with your average everyday space station visit?
Well, it's a lot longer than an average stay. Visits tend to be about 6.5 months, and she'll be up there nearly 11 months. I think her current schedule has her clocking in at 328 days, and that will make her the NASA astronaut with the second longest single stay after Scott Kelly, who was up there for 340 days. And it will make her it'll make her the worldwide record holder for the longest female astronaut.
And there are a lot of unanswered questions, right, about what it's like for us humans to be up in orbit. What are some of the main biological question marks?
Sure. So it's really a matter of there are some symptoms that people have noticed, but they're not sure exactly how those play out. So there are some big concerns like losing bone density and losing muscle definition. And there are some known effects on cognitive performance, but it's really unclear how that translates the longer and longer you stay up there and even looking beyond low Earth orbit, if you're thinking about trying to go to the moon or going to Mars, that brings up a whole new set of questions because there's a lot more radiation out there. Astronauts on the space station are exposed to more radiation than they normally are here, but they're still a little bit sheltered. Once they leave low Earth orbit, it gets worse.
And you mentioned Scott Kelly being up there for 340 days. Now we've got Christina Cook. Is there a thought that, hey, maybe men's bodies and women's bodies might react differently to prolonged periods in orbit?
That's definitely something that doctors I've spoken with have wanted to look into. So a lot fewer women have flown in space overall than men, which makes comparisons a little bit difficult. But there are a few factors where scientists have noticed differences between how sexes respond to space flight. So for one common issue is that women tend to faint more when they get back to Earth, which seems to have something to do with how their artery system responds to being in microgravity for so long and then coming back and having Earth gravity again. And another difference that people have already sort of started to notice is that both men and women, their eyes change. You can see it in scans of their heads while they're in space. But then when they get back, men seem to have more trouble actually with their vision, whereas women, it seems to be a little less of a symptom, but they still see the effects in the scan. So they're not sure exactly what's going on there.
How well are scientists and doctors able to sort out, okay, this is something that happened to Scott Kelly in orbit or something that we'll find out happened to Christina Cook in orbit? How much of that is them as individuals versus this is what happens to people, any people in orbit?
That's really one of the big questions, because there are so few people who have flown in space. There are so few people who have flown for long periods of time. There are three NASA astronauts so far who have stayed longer than 200 days in orbit. Christina Cook will be the fourth. But yeah, it's really difficult for them to know. They're never going to be able to do as large of a controlled trial as you would do for something more mundane, something on Earth. So it's really hard to pick that apart. And so the more flights you can get up there helps, but there's always going to be some level of questions to that, I think.
You mentioned we were going to, say, Mars, we'd be exposed to more radiation, but also that's a much longer trip than even this almost a year we're talking about. What kind of time spans are we talking about if we're going to Mars?
People tend to give that sort of a 2.5-year time frame because it takes a while to get there, and then assuming you want to do something once you get there, and then it takes a while to get back here. So 2.5 years is usually sort of the default time frame people give, but of course it could go a little bit either way.
Talking to Megan Bartels, senior writer at space.com, about spending a lot of time in orbit or beyond and what impact that has on the human body. And we mentioned, Megan, that Christina Cook found out that she was going to have this longer stay while she was already up there on the space station. Do we know her reaction to that news?
Well, she did know it was a possibility before she went up. So it wasn't totally sprung on her. But the
official
confirmation, what we know, did come after she was already up.
But she is on board with this idea. Not that she may have much choice in the matter.
Yeah, no, she seems very excited in the interviews that she's done since the announcement. She seems really thrilled to have the extra time up there.
Now, getting back to Scott Kelly, who holds that longest space flight record, he had this unique situation where he has a twin brother, and they were able to do some before and after comparisons, one in space, one clearly not. What kind of things did we learn from that?
Sure. So coincidentally, the findings from that just came out the week before they announced Christina Cook's long stay, so it's an interesting turn of events. But the Scott Kelly, Mark Kelly situation was really interesting because they did have this identical twin here on Earth. So they could actually look at, in a nearly identical genome, they could look at the actual expression of genes as the long mission progressed. So they could see what genes were being expressed more and what genes were being expressed less while Scott was up there, and then how that changed when he came back. So there were definitely some... they noticed some questions in mitochondrial gene expressions and some signs of immunological stress, in addition to some sort of more standard, less genetically based signs of space flight. So sort of because you don't have gravity, your fluid moves around a lot, and that can cause your body to do weird things. for the most part, sort of those all of those factors went back to normal by about 6 months after he got back. But yeah, still lots to be learned.
Now, in the public imagination, or I'll speak for myself, in the way I think of space flight, I guess I've thought of it as, you know, an engineering challenge. It's physics and chemistry and the math. I should have been thinking more about the biology all along, it sounds like.
Well, fortunately, other people have. People have always been really curious about how human bodies respond to space flight. So.
And does that go back quite a ways to earlier missions?
Yeah, so all along, basically, as soon as NASA was looking at human spaceflight, there were doctors involved sort of trying to figure out what they wanted to know from spaceflight and how they wanted to try to screen astronauts who might have conditions that became problematic in space.
And I want to spend our last couple minutes on another story that you wrote, kind of related. Christina Cook now, as you said, will be the woman spending the most time in space in human history. You recently wrote about Jerry Cobb. She was the first woman to pass the equivalent of NASA's pre-flight space test. She passed away last month. Can you tell us some about what she accomplished and the doors that she may have opened, even if she didn't always get to walk through them herself?
Yeah, of course. So she was a very accomplished pilot in the late 50s and early 60s. And so in 1960, when these doctors who were working with NASA to sort of try to figure out how to find people who could handle spaceflight and how to test them and, like, what to look for when they were up there, they reached out to her because she was a very, very well-known pilot. She had broken several records and was very talented. So they reached out to Jerry Cobb and asked her to take those same tests that they had set up and created for NASA. They didn't do that through the auspices of NASA. They did it as a private project. But she agreed. She passed all the tests with flying colors. And then she also went through the pilot records of the U.S. to find other women who seemed like they were talented enough that it made sense to have them take the test as well. She found 25 of them and to talk into taking these tests, and 12 of them passed. So there was, over the course of a few years, this group of 13 women came together who were qualified to fly in space and had passed these physical tests that people thought ought to qualify them to make a space flight. NASA never quite got on board with this project, but Jerry Cobb did a lot of lobbying, including in Congress. She eventually testified in Congress in 1962 about sort of this practice and really pushing against this NASA decision to not fly women at such an early point. That never made a whole lot of progress, and the Soviet Union sent the first woman into space in 1963. So sort of by the mid-60s, she had backed away from this. But it's really, it's particularly striking because it does come before sort of the coalescence of the second wave of feminism, which would have really helped her and backed her up. And it came before sex discrimination was illegal. So testifying in Congress about this was a really big deal, and getting them to listen and to really see this as a potential problem was a big accomplishment.
And you write that a lot of people nowadays, scientists, those in the space program, look at Jerry Cobb as an inspiration, right?
Oh, definitely, yeah. The first female pilot of the space shuttle program, Eileen Collins, she piloted the shuttle in 1995. And when she was getting ready to launch, she reached out to these women and organized to have a bunch of them attend her launch on site because she really thought they had helped pave the way for her own flight.
Megan, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Megan Bartel, senior writer at space.com. She's with us to talk about how NASA is researching the impact of prolonged space flight on the human body. Coming up, heavy rain is possible for parts of Wisconsin today. We'll talk about what that means for the ongoing flooding situation in many rivers around the state. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Trump administration will be shifting some of the inspection duties at pork slaughterhouses from USDA staff to industry employees. Talk with a reporter about concerns the plan is raising among some food safety experts. First, heavy rain is in the forecast for parts of Wisconsin today, which could bring more flooding problems along certain rivers. In Portage, the Wisconsin River crested at about 20 feet yesterday. As the river rose, officials in Columbia and Sauk counties were recommending some people evacuate in selected areas. Meanwhile, flood warnings are in effect for other portions of the Wisconsin, the Mississippi, and rivers in the northeastern part of the state. In addition to rain, there's also a chance of severe weather, possibly a tornado. Jeff Last is the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Green Bay. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, sounds like a busy time to be a meteorologist today. Can you round up how much flooding we've seen or risk of flooding around the state in the last couple of days?
Well, you know, the heavy snow we had late this past winter and the period of heavy rains over the last couple of weeks, and really the last 4 or 5 weeks, has caused those high river levels. And currently we're looking at high river levels on the Mississippi River, the Wisconsin River, the Menominee River, the Wolf and Yellow River, all over central and northeast Wisconsin and all over the state, really.
And I'm seeing signs or seeing news that at least some of these rivers crested yesterday and the levels are starting to go down. Is that the case for most of the rivers you just mentioned?
It's true with parts of the Wisconsin River. The Mississippi River, there are still some areas where the crests have not occurred yet. For example, in southwest Wisconsin. The same is true in parts of the Menominee River in the far northeast. We'll see that river cresting near McAllister, Wisconsin, looks like on early Friday. But on parts of the Wisconsin River, that is true that we did see the crest, like in Portage, for example, where it did crest on Sunday, I believe it was.
And there in Portage, they were just shy of the all-time record there, and that was set in 2010. Do we know why that part of the Wisconsin River in particular got so high?
Well, there was just an incredible amount of snow all the way through northern and central Wisconsin this winter, in particular the second half of this winter, and that along with the moderate to heavy rain that we had in late winter and the first part of spring just caused that river to rise. There are some dams that control the flow on the river, so that does help somewhat. But in Portage, that area can be susceptible to flooding like we saw back in 2010, and certainly that was the case here this spring.
Now, we are looking at some rain around the state today. Is there enough to where it's going to make this problem worse, or compared to that flood melt-off you're talking about, is that just a drop in the river?
It's certainly not going to help matters. This rainfall that we have currently over northwest Wisconsin, with additional storms forming over Iowa, that'll be moving into Wisconsin late this afternoon and overnight. These showers that are occurring this week will slow the river levels from falling. So that means that areas that are flooded or near bankfill will continue to be so. But again, certainly not like what we saw earlier on. I don't expect any record levels to be set just because of the rain that we're going to see overnight tonight.
Now, we have in some very focused areas around the state some evacuation warnings. Are there, I know you're not with emergency management, but are there any points in flooding along any Wisconsin River that you're really paying a close eye on right now?
I think the worst flooding, around Portage, hopefully that peak has ended and the river will continue to slowly fall. Certainly, people who are under evacuation should follow their local officials because they have the best measurement on how to how to work with those situations. In southwest Wisconsin with the Mississippi River, that will be cresting a bit later on. So again, I think all local officials have the best the best information for their citizens.
Talking to Jeff Last, warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Green Bay, looking at flooding and other weather-related issues around Wisconsin. Jeff, taking a step back, when it comes to flooding, it seems like timing is everything. We might get the same amount of average snowfall or the same amount of precipitation over the course of a winter. The question is, when does it happen and how fast does it melt? Is that part of the flooding story, especially in the spring?
Yes, the spring snowmelt flooding is a delicate dance with the snow that melts and the spring rains that are bound to commence. And what we saw this year was the worst of both, because we had the heavy snow in the second half of the winter, the melt of that snow, and then the heavy rains that came all together within, you know, a 6 or 8 week period. And we're still seeing the effects of that perfect timing, the perfect storm.
I want to look ahead a little bit now. We've got some rain and possible thunderstorms in the forecast, I think still tonight. What are you watching for around the state for serious weather?
Well, we're watching storms that are forming over northeast Iowa. And there are a couple of warnings, actually, for large hail with a couple of those storms west of the Quad Cities and south of La Crosse. Those storms are moving northeast and will enter southern Wisconsin at some point. Whether they're still severe or not, that remains to be seen. But certainly the atmosphere is capable of producing an isolated severe storm over southern Wisconsin, which could produce a high wind gust or large hail. And that's all thanks to an area of low pressure over Iowa, which is moving into southern Wisconsin this afternoon and overnight tonight.
I'd seen at some point maybe possible conditions for a tornado. Is that not what we're looking for anymore at this point for this one?
No, there is a very small chance of an isolated tornado over southern Wisconsin. There's a lot of spin in the atmosphere when you have low pressure systems that move across the area. So that'll be something we'll be watching over the next 4 or 5 hours as that weather system moves across the state.
Now, looking ahead, Jeff, I still haven't gotten my snow tires changed off of my car. I know I've been burned on late April snowstorms. Any risk of that in the forecast for the remainder of this month?
It looks pretty low to nil. I think the weather pattern we're in now, while certainly not really warm and summer-like, I don't think we'll have any snow. Any significant snow, certainly, over much of the state. Now, across the far north, there's always that chance.
Sure.
As the cold air moves in from Canada. And that'll happen, you know, into early May even sometimes. But I think overall, I think we've passed that peak of snow chances here.
And then I know it can be tougher to make the longer range forecasts, but are there thoughts on what we're looking for the rest of spring when it comes to temperatures and rain?
Yeah. There is some indication of temperatures that'll be around or perhaps a bit above normal as we go into this next part of springtime. Precipitation looks, you know, plus or minus an inch or so of average. I don't see anything that would signal a really heavy rain event over a long period of time in the next part of spring, although any thunderstorm can drop a lot of rain in one location. But as far as widespread heavy rains across the state, I don't see any indications of that, at least at this point, for the next over the next month.
And Jeff, we've seen tornadoes hitting hard in other parts of the country. What kind of things, as a warning coordination meteorologist, what are the early warning signs you're watching for here in Wisconsin for possible tornado risks?
Well, here in Wisconsin, April and May starts our tornado season, and what we look for are those low-pressure systems and the clash of the air masses, the warm, moist air moving in from the south, and, you know, the cold air still hanging around Canada and the northern plains. When we get that clash of air masses and that those areas of low pressure which move along those boundaries, that's our concern for outbreaks of severe weather. And again, we are getting into severe weather season here in Wisconsin, so that'll be our focus as we go into the next few months.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jeff Last, Warning Coordination Meteorologist with the National Weather Service. He's based in Green Bay. He joined us for a look at the flooding situation in rivers around Wisconsin and a look ahead at what the rest of the spring might look like. Last we heard, the Wisconsin River at Portage crested yesterday at about 20 feet, close to but not quite hitting a record set back in 2010. Also, flood warnings along the Mississippi River and a few in northeastern and central Wisconsin, plus a flood watch for much of northern Wisconsin. Look for your local emergency management officials to see what's going on in your area and to pay attention, Jeff says, to those evacuation orders if they come out. Whoever finds this, write back to me. Tell me where and when you found this. That's from a message in a bottle found on the shores of Lake Michigan. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, an 11-year-old in Oostburg found a mysterious bottle while playing with rocks on the shore. On further inspection, it had a note inside written on the back of a placemat from the SS Badger ferry. The note had stayed dry, though the 11-year-old says the note smelled very bad, like rotten cheese. The note was dated July 27th, 1998. The author shared his name, his hometown, Two Rivers, the home of the ice cream sundae, and some of his thoughts on the sports and pop culture of the time. The family reached out to Jim Stingel of the Journal Sentinel to help track down the person who wrote the note. It turns out he still lives in Wisconsin. He'd forgotten writing that letter and that he most likely did it on a red-eye trip on the ferry while the rest of his family was sleeping. One side note, he wrote, "Packers are awesome, Bucks suck, Brewers suck." As Jim Stingel from the Journal Sentinel notes, that, quote, gives a reminder that good teams can falter and bad teams can get better. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.